Okay, good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. So today we're going to continue talking about caches. And as a reference, we're going to talk about where they fit in and, you know, what they actually look like. So this is a press photo of the innards of a 2004 processor. I'm using a 2004 processor because I could actually find out where things like the registers are on it, which is a little harder to do with a more modern processor that you can find photos like this. So a more modern processor, this would be a single core, roughly, and you know, about a tenth the size. So these are the registers here. They're their fastest memory. And ideally, we'd like to do all our calculations with registers because that's how we get the maximum possible performance. But usually, we're going to try to communicate with a cache. And these are exactly the data and instruction memories we saw in our processor. These are going to be our first level caches. And this processor has two first level caches. One is a data cache. So that's this processor's data memory. When it talks to data memory, it uses this block of the chip, which you notice has a regular pattern here. And that's because it's a cache. It has lots of repeated storage of different sets of the cache. And we also have an instruction cache, which looks similar. And they're split up because you need data and instructions in different parts of the processor. And it's easier to make two caches, which you can access simultaneously, than one cache you can access twice at the same time. So those are the L1 caches. And this processor has a big L2 cache, which is the entire side of the chip here. It's a 1 megabyte cache. And this was the last level cache in the processor. So after this, in this processor, was memory. And yes, it really is that much of the CPU. And this is very typical. If you look at a typical chip, modern chip, caches will be a majority of the area of the CPU. Because you want to store as much as you have space for, and it's really worth the space investment for the performance you get. So, L2 here. And on more modern chips, you usually have a third level of cache, an L3 cache, which is not on this chip because it's from 2004, before they had enough difference between memory performance and register performance for that to be an issue. But now the gap is widened, so usually you'll have an L3 cache. This chip doesn't have one. So something to notice is that there's one L2 cache, even though there are two separate L1 caches. And this is a typical division. After we get to the point where we have data and instruction caches separate for being fast to access for each individually, we stop caring about having that split. It's more useful to just have one big cache. You have the maximum storage for everything. And our big advantage is that we get an increase in latency as we go down this hierarchy. So everything that's smaller is going to be faster because it's smaller. Just physically, the signals have to travel less, so it's faster. And we can make it out of more expensive technology per byte. So that means that typically registers in a modern processor, these are times for a modern processor, not 2004, take less than a nanosecond to access. Cache, an L1 cache, will take around a nanosecond or two. An L2 will take like 5 to 10. L3 might be like 20. And main memory is going to be something around 100. These are all approximate numbers. They change. But it really is this multiple orders of magnitude difference in access latencies. And note that I'm talking about latency here and not bandwidth. So the bandwidth is also different, but it's not as different. But what we care about in executing an instruction is typically latency, because we get an address and we need that value before we can do anything more. And in the processor that we've seen, we can't really do anything else while we're doing that. And we're waiting for that answer. So the overall goal of doing caching is going to be to make everything seem to have this sort of 1 nanosecond performance, no matter how much stuff you're accessing. And our hope is that our caches have a high enough hit rate that that actually happens. That, you know, that this 100 nanosecond time to go to main memory, we only see that, you know, 0.001% of the time. And so it's not significant. Whether we succeed in that or not is going to depend on what programs we're running and what our caches look like. So as I said, that box that was labeled data memory in our processor diagrams is exactly the L1 caches. So the data memory is exactly the L1 data cache. And the instruction memory is exactly the L1 instruction cache. And these take our usual inputs, read and write enable, input, give us an output, etc. And because these caches take variable amounts of time, when they actually communicate with the CPU, they give some indication of whether they actually have a value, whether it was a hit, or you have to wait longer. And the caches are going to be the entity responsible for communicating with the next level of the memory hierarchy, be that main memory, or an L2 cache, or an L3 cache. So our data and instruction memory, when they don't have a value, they're going to say, hey, I'm not ready, and they're going to talk to the L2 cache to get a value. So our typical operation using the cache is going to look like that the CPU says, hey, I'd like to read a value. And sometimes the cache won't have it. And the cache will communicate with memory for the CPU. And in this case, we're actually making the memory access slower because we have an extra step here. We didn't just send it to memory. But that's OK because usually, we hope, the CPU will say, hey, I want a value, and the cache will just give it back without talking to memory because it has a copy. But in order to make this actually better, we need a really high hit rate. You know, so typically, we're going to look for an over 99% hit rates from our caches for this reason, to make it worth, you know, that extra step if we actually have to talk to memory, you know, and all this complexity. This is, and to hide that latency factor of, you know, 2 orders of magnitude. Okay, so let's look concretely at how we might actually organize a cache. So we mentioned last time that we had sets in our cache where we placed values, and we need some way of looking them up and getting them. And we're going to start with the simplest way of organizing a cache, which is the direct map cache. So I'm going to have 4 places I can put values in my cache, just to keep things simple. And to make things as simple as possible, I'm only going to put each block of memory here in one place. And rather than storing 1 byte of memory per block, I'm going to store 2. Because usually, if you're going to read, you know, 1 byte, you're going to read something next to it. So caches are usually going to store blocks of more than 1 byte. So here, we've chosen to have blocks of 2 bytes. And I've written out memory divided into blocks of the same size. And to keep things simple, I'm always going to read memory starting at an even address, because I have blocks of size 2. I'm never going to, you know, read the block containing 1, 1, and 2, 2. I'm always going to read the block 0, 0, 1, 1, or 2, 2, 3, 3. This is going to make my lookup simpler. It's going to make it easier to reason about, you know, how to use this cache. So let's say we want to read the byte at 01011, that address, which is this down here, so it's BB. So the first thing we're going to want to do is we're going to say, well, which of these values in my cache do I need to look at? And we need to decide on some policy for how values are assigned to the cache. So the simplest policy is going to be to say, okay, this first entry here goes to the first block of memory. The second one goes to the second. The third one goes to the third. The fourth one goes to the fourth. And then, well, we've run out of blocks to assign to, so we just start over. We say the first goes to the next one, and so on. So we just basically, assign this to each block, first come, first served. Another way of looking at it is if you overlay this sort of cache on memory, we just have one copy which says where we put things. And the way this works out is that if you number the blocks of the cache, so 0, 1, 2, 3, and look at some bits of the address, it's going to turn out that they're exactly the same. And this is just because if we chop off the last bit, because that tells us what part of the block we're in, so each of these blocks of memory is identified by the top 4 bits of their address, because they have one value with 0 in the lower bit and one value with 1 in the lower bit. That tells us the number of the block in memory. So this is block 0 of memory, block 1, block 2, and so on. And if we look at the bottom 2 bits of that, that's the block of memory modulo 4, or the remainder dividing that the block of memory number by 4. And that corresponds exactly to these last 2 bits. And that's going to give us the number between 0 and 4, which when we add 1, increases to the next block. And this turns out to be something we definitely want to happen. And this is a reason I chose to have 4 blocks instead of 5. Because with 4 blocks, since we have these bits exactly coinciding, I don't need to do any complicated, annoying division to figure out what's, 7 divided by 5, what's the remainder. I don't need to do that to figure out where things go. I just look at a couple bits. And in hardware, that's going to be much faster than doing division all the time to figure out how things map to the cache, or even doing some sort of hash function. So this is almost always what hardware wants to do to look up something in a cache. It just wants to look at a few bits of the address, and that's going to be it. And this is going to be a reason why every single cache you're going to see is going to have lots of things which are close to powers of 2. Because powers of 2 make it possible that when you divide and take the remainder, you're just going to be looking at a subset of bits. And that means that you don't have to actually implement a real divider. It's fine if you think of it as dividing for figuring out where things go yourself, but in a processor, that's not acceptable. So given this, we have this sort of mapping where you just copy the pattern. And here it turns out there's our BB. It goes to the second block of the cache, index 1. And we can tell that because the 01 in the address tells us the set number, the index we go to. And this is what a direct map cache looks like. So direct map cache has one thing per index. And this is exactly how we figure out where that is based on the address. So our next step is going to be, okay, so I know where it goes. I know that it belongs right here. Well, is this the value I want there? There's a 0000. Is that the value at that memory address? Well, we're missing some information to know that. So this is not going to be enough for a cache. So we need to know, well, hey, is this 0000 even a value from memory? Because our cache has to start with something. And we want to have it be able to start empty. We don't want to have to load memory into our cache in order to start our processor. So we're going to have an extra bit to know, hey, did I ever load anything into this block? Did I ever store any value here? And it's going to start out of a 0. And when it's 0, that tells us it's not valid, that I didn't put anything here. So when you're looking up this address here, well, that 0000 there, that's not a real value. You shouldn't use it. You need to go to memory instead. And I know that because this valid bit says don't look there. So it's invalid, and what we're going to do is we're going to fetch this value from memory and put it in our cache. Because our assumption is that we can take advantage of a locality, and this is how we're going to do it. By when we don't see something in our cache, we're going to add it. And assume that that means later on, we're actually going to use this value again. And so to load the value in cache, we're going to set this valid bit to 1, because now this thing we stored here is actually a value from memory. It actually is something we want to use later. But that's not enough. So our problem is that, well, this value could have been from this location in memory. How do we know it's not that? If later on you ask me instead of for 01011, you ask me for 00011, if you ask me for this other address, how do I know that that's 33 and not BB? How do I not use this value for that? So we need some way of knowing, okay, this is the particular address, even though there's multiple things I could have put there, that I actually have in them. And we could just store the entire address. We could store this whole address here. But that's a waste of space, because not everything can go there. We don't need to store the entire address. We only need to store the parts that, you know, distinguish it from other things which could go there. And we already used the bottom bit to tell where in the block we are. This bottom bit, if it's 0, it's the first byte of the block. If it's 1, it's the second byte. So we don't need to store the bottom bit in our cache to know what address we fetched, because it's always, we've used all those values for the things we're storing. And we don't need to store the bits we use to look up the set number, the next two bits in this case, because we know that everything that is in here has 0, 1 in those bits. So we don't need to store those bits. It wouldn't be wrong to, but it's a waste of space. So the remaining bits, which in this case we have two of them, are going to be what we need to store in the cache. So later on, when we try to read this value again, we can look up this and say, oh, does this 0, 1 match that 0, 1? And if it does, we know, yeah, this is the act value I want. Otherwise, we know, oh, I have to go to memory. Okay. So any questions about this general sort of construction of a direct map cache? Okay, so this is a picture I find helpful for explaining what the cache is actually doing, and it's remarkably similar to what the memory looks like. So typically, the way caches are implemented is you have a memory which takes an address, which is going to be our index from before. It tells us what value we could have the value in, and the memory is going to output our data and all our extra information that we need to store, which in this case is our valid bit and our tag. And then to implement the cache, we're going to take this extra information and use it. So the first thing we want to do is look at the tag and say, oh, does that equal the tag I got in my address? So we're going to take the output of this cache here when we send in the right index and look at that tag and say, is it equal? And we're also going to say, is this valid bit I got out, is that 1? And if the tag is equal and the valid bit is 1, we know it's a hit. We know that we can tell the CPU, hey, your value is ready. And if it's not, we know we have to go to memory. Then we have to take this value, this data we have stored here, which is multiple bytes. And we have to return the right part of it. So if our processor is only asking for 1 byte, which is not what our guided memories do, but I didn't want to draw, 16 bytes and selecting 8 of them, because that would be ridiculously big. But if our processor is asking for 1 byte, we're going to take this offset here, which is the number of the byte in each block. So this is 102. So that means we want, yes. Depending which direction I've written these in. So this is 0, 1, 2, 3 in the way I've written it. So we're going to want 1, 2 here. Or, sorry, this is 0, 1, 2, so 2 here. But basically, we take our data out, divide it into bytes or 64-bit values, or whatever size our memory needs to return to the processor. And we choose which one we get with the big mux, which is input from that offset, the remaining bits of the address, which tell us where in the block we are. And something I didn't deal with here is, well, what happens if you want to access something which crosses over to blocks in the cache? And we're just going to say, don't do that. And if you look at real processors, many processors support accessing things which will cross between blocks in the cache, but they support it in a way which is a lot slower. And so that's the real solution, is that they access the cache twice, and it's slower. But for now, we're just going to say we don't do that, that everything we're accessing is going to be either completely in one cache block or not in the cache at all. So one important thing when figuring out how caches work is going to be, well, how did I know that there were 2 bits for the tag here? How did I know that I needed 3 bits to figure out what set to get out of the cache, which row? And how did I know I needed 2 bits to figure out what part of the block I'm accessing? So let's look at, you know, what that, how that changes, and you know, how you're going to figure out how much there is. Let's say, take this address here, you know, which is set to FF, and it's in each of these caches. How do we actually look up that value in each of these caches? And I have 3 different cache arrangements here. So I have 2, which have 2-byte blocks, 1, which has 4-byte blocks, and varying numbers of sets as in where they can store values. And these are all direct mapped. We'll go to non-direct map caches later. So the first thing that you'd probably figure out is how you figure out the location in a block. So here we're looking at 1 byte. So 1 byte, you know, that means that the address changes by 1 to specify the byte. But we have blocks with 2 bytes, which means the address changes by 2 to specify which block of memory it is. And the amount of bytes we can store in a block tells us how big our offset needs to be. So if we need 1 bit to store the byte number in the block, which we need for 2 bytes, that's a 1 bit offset. So this lower bit of the address here for these 2-byte block caches tells us whether it's the first byte of the block or the second. So we need 1 bit because there's 2 possibilities. In this other cache here, there are 4 possibilities. And to represent 4 possible values, you need 2 bits. So the offset is going to be 2 bits, the last 2 bits of the address. And that tells us that we go to 0, 1, 2, 3 is the index of the byte in the block that we want. So next thing we're going to look at is how do we figure out what row of the cache we're interested in. So we want to look at the number of rows for that. And it's the same philosophy. If we have 4 rows, that's 4 sets, then we need 2 bits to say which row we care about. Because there's 4 possibilities. So 2 to the 2 is 4. So there's going to be 2 bits for this cache with 4 sets to figure out which index we want. If we have 8 rows, we need 3 bits to figure out which of the 8 we have. And if we only have 2, we just need 1 bit. And if you don't have a power of 2, that's not a direct map cache. So then we have the thing which I think generally tricks people up most, which is the tag. So what goes in the tag for, say, this first address? Who can tell me how you figure this out? So I've said that our offset is that 1. The index is this 1, 1. So what's in the tag? Yes. Exactly. So it's the ones that are left over. Because everything that we didn't already use, we need to have around in order to say, is this actually what I want that's stored in that block of the cache? So everything that's left over, so the 3 bits for the first and last case, and 2 bits for the other case, everything that's left over, we need to put in the tag. Because this makes sure that we know we can reconstruct the entire address. So you notice that if you look at tag and index and offset across this row, that's the same as the original address, 001111, same as what we have here. And if you do it for the second row, it's the same thing. And for the third row, it's the same thing. And that's always going to be true, that between the tag, the index, and the offset in the block, we have the entire address reconstructed. And that's how we know the tag gives us all the information we need to get the whole address once we know where it is in the cache. So our book summarizes this with these formulas, which is one way you can think about it. I'm perfectly fine with you doing these calculations by memorizing these formulas and just doing algebra. So the number of sets is 2 to the number of index bits. So you can solve for big S or little s, depending on what you need to do. The number of blocks is 2 to the number of block offset bits.
Number of bytes in block.
Or bytes in, yeah, sorry.
Number of blocks.
The block size, yeah, is that. Number of blocks is sets as far as we know right now. And the tag bits are the index bits plus the offset bits subtracted from the number of bits in the address total, which on our processor is 64 bits. And then we have this idea of cache size. So when we talk about cache sizes, we're talking about the size of the cache without all this extra data like valid bits and tags. So when you see someone quoting a cache size, they're not including that overhead, even though that's really actually stored in the cache. There is real space taken up by that, but this is not what we call the cache size. If people are going to tell you what the size of that is, they're going to say that like the size of the overhead or the tags or something like that. So our cache size is our block size times the number of sets for a direct map cache, because we have 1 block per set. The set also has some information about whether it's valid and what the tag is, but that's not going to be part of what we call the cache size. Yes?
So I think the book gives like a different equation for cache size.
So this is for a direct map cache. So later on, we're going to add associativity to this, which is going to, you know, make this a little more complicated. But this is just a special case of the general equation.
And also, are we all usually given the number of sets as like a...
I think it would be fair game to give you anything which lets you solve the equations.
Cool. There's a problem in the quiz that I don't know where to find it.
Okay. You had a question?
I was actually going to say about the E missing.
Yeah. So we'll add that back later. So in this case, E is 1. So let's walk through what a cache does when we actually access it to figure out, you know, how does this cache actually operate. And this is something you should try to get comfortable with, because if you want to figure out, you know, what's the performance of my program with the cache? You should be able to say, you know, walk through, if I try to access this, then this, what's the cache going to do? What things are actually going to be stored in the cache? So here's a list of memory accesses. I've given the address in binary and hexadecimal. Binary because we're going to want to split it up into the index and the tag and the offset, and that's easier to do for binary, generally, and in hexadecimal so I can actually read it. And the first thing we need to do if you have a problem like this where I give you this picture of a cache and a bunch of memory addresses is you're going to need to figure out what the number of index bits are and what the block size is and the number of block offset bits so you can divide up the addresses. Because you need to know what row of the cache do I look in for each of these addresses. And you also need to know like what part of it's going to be the tag if we're going to ask you what tag is stored in the cache. And the way this works out for these addresses is that there's one offset bit. So this last bit here in gray is the offset. And there's five tag bits. And these two bits in the middle are the index. So now with the values highlighted like this, we can go through and figure out what ends up in the cache. So we can just go through access by access. So first, we access index 0. So this row of the cache. And we just say, OK, if we're reading that, first of all, is it a hit? So is this access to 00 in the address 0, which is in this first set, is that a hit? So people aren't enthusiastic, but some people are vaguely shaking their head. So it's not. And the reason we know is because this valid bit is 0. It doesn't matter I didn't tell you what was in the rest of it. The valid bit is 0. That means we can't possibly have a value here to read from the cache. So it's not a hit. And because we assume we're going to access that value later, we're going to load it into the cache. So it's going to be what's called a miss. That means that it wasn't in our cache. And we're going to load it into the cache. So we're going to set all the parts of this cache entry based on the value we got from memory. So we're going to store the actual things we got from memory in the data part of the set. And we're going to store the tag from the address so we know later on where we got it from. And we're also going to set the valid bit to 1 because we actually have a meaningful value. So later on, in our next access, we're going to start with the same procedure. We're going to say, OK, 00 is the index. So we're going to say, let's look at what's in 00 here. First of all, is it valid? Well, in this case, valid bit is 1, so yes. So that means I need to look at the tag. I say the tag is 00000. And I look at the address I'm accessing here, and well, that's the same thing. So that means we have a hit. Doesn't tell us what the value we get is yet, because we need to use the offset. And the offset here is 1. That means we get the second byte stored in this entry. And so this is a hit, and it's going to read this byte, which is not the one we just loaded before. And this is an example of how our cache is taking advantage of spatial locality. Because we accessed two different addresses here, and the second access was a hit because it was in the same block. So by choosing a block size that's not 1 byte, we not only made it easier to draw a larger cache on my slides, but we also got better performance as long as our program has spatial locality, as long as we access values with close memory addresses close in time. So we can run through this procedure for another access. So here, we're looking at index 1. And again, just like at the first time, we need to load the value because it started out as invalid. So we added it to the cache. And we can do that again. So another thing which is going to happen is sometimes we'll look up a value. So we're going to look up this 61 here. It has index 0. So it's this row, and it's valid. Then we check the tag. So the tag is 0 here. That's not 0. So this is a, so sorry, that's not 0. So it's going to be a miss. So it's a miss only because the tag disagrees. We still have a value stored in this entry of the cache, but it's not the one that we requested. And just like any other miss, even though there's something already there, we're going to replace it. So we're going to change the tag to the value we got from memory and change these values we were storing from storing address 0 and 1 to storing address 60 and 61. And our assumption is that hopefully we're more likely to read 61 later than 00. That's not a, yeah. Sorry. This is a, yeah. I have the slides missed. So reading 62 will be a hit now because it's in the cache. And you can figure this out more manually by saying that 1 has 62. And I just the wrong order. So later on, let's say we're reading 0 again. And if you just looked at this access pattern, you'd say, oh, you know, it's a small cache. We're not reading that many things. This should be a hit again. But it's not. And this is true even though we have this last entry of the cache, which is empty. So following our same procedure as before, and this entry is also empty. So following the same procedure as before, we look up address index 0 here. We look up our valid bit and say, is this valid? Yes, it is. And then we look for a tag, and well, it's not right. Our tag says that's you know the value we loaded here. It's not the value we want for address 0. So it's miss. And after miss, we're going to replace the value with the value from address 0. And this is called a conflict miss. It's a conflict miss because we have two whole entries of the cache, you know, which we're not really using. But the problem was that we accessed address 61 and address 0, and they both use the same set of the cache. They both have no other option. So even though we had plenty of space in the cache, we ended up having cache misses and loading a value and not being able to reuse it, even though we had an access close in time. And conflict misses are a big problem with this design of cache, because it's easy to accidentally have cases where two important values in your program happen to share the index bits. Because you usually don't write programs keeping in mind, what are the index bits of this variable? Do they coincide with the index bits of my loop counter? Who knows? You don't think about that. And your compiler generally doesn't think too hard about that. So you can have accidents where you have this addresses coinciding. And even though there's no problem with locality, we still have good temporal locality and spatial locality, we get cache misses. And this is particularly bad with direct map caches because there's no second chance for a value. And we, so we end up with cases like this where all our accesses to this first doc are a miss, even though, you know, we're not storing that much stuff. So our fix to this is going to be to add associativity. So rather than having just one place to store a value, we're going to have multiple. And that means that when we have this case where we have address 0 and address 60 that go to the same part of the cache, that we're not going to need to worry about only having one place to put everything. that instead of having one block per set, we're going to have two sets with two blocks each. Just as before, each of these are going to have an index. And so by increasing the associativity of the cache, I got rid of some index bits because we have less possible indexes to put things in. And our calculations are just as before. And that's because I was careful when presenting what our numbers were to use the number of sets and not the number of blocks. So for figuring out what the number of index bits are and the number of block offset bits is exactly the same. It's just that we count sets, which could have multiple blocks, and not blocks. So we have one index bit instead of two, but everything else about this is the same as before. We have 2 bytes per block, so we have one block offset bit, and you know, our tag bits are just whatever is left over, just as before. There's one more tag bit because we lost an index bit. And we can do the same thing and look at how we access values. So in this case, we're going to, you know, to get address 0, we're going to do the same procedure, but we have two choices about where to put it. We're just arbitrarily going to put it in our first slot. And once again, we still have hits from spatial locality from things being in the same block. That hasn't changed. But here, instead of needing to replace this value here, we have an extra place to put it. So when we load 6-1 from memory, now we don't have to replace 0-0 that we loaded earlier because we have a choice. And we're definitely not going to use the thing that's not valid first. We want to use as much space in the cache as possible. So this is going to be a miss. But later on, our access to address 0 is going to be a hit. So we've avoided the conflict miss by adding associativity. And this is the reason why many, one of the reasons why many caches are not direct mapped, but are what is called set associative. They have this property where you have multiple places to store values, and that means that when you just happen to have a coincidence in the index bits, you don't run into trouble. You know, you don't have this spurious miss, even though you have good locality. So a problem we have still is, you know, what if we have another access to the same set? So here, address 6-4, it has 0 in its index bit, and that goes to this first set. And we have two choices about where to put it. We want to put it somewhere, because our assumption is that if we're accessing it now, we're going to access it soon again later. So we need to choose which one of these two values is our victim, which one we're going to replace with address 6-4. And we'll get that back to that in a bit. So first, let's look at how our read case is different from before. So we have the same sort of procedure where we get our index and access a row of our cache. This time, just instead of getting out one valid bit and one tag and one set of data, we get out two. And we compare both the tags and both the valid bits. And whichever one of them are both true, that's the block we want, if the value is in the cache. So we use that to select with, a mux, which of these two possibilities for the data we actually want. And if none of the tags match, we don't care what this mux does because we're not going to use this value. We're going to go to memory instead. And otherwise, after we get that, figure out which set of data to get, the procedure is the same. We use the offset part of the address to figure out which byte we're getting. So questions about sort of this procedure? So we have this question of, well, we have this miss here, and we need to replace one of these values. We need to choose where we actually insert it. And we don't really have enough information here to make the right choice. So last time we mentioned a policy that we want to use, which is least recently used. The idea being that we want to replace the oldest value, because it's most likely to not be used in the future. We assume that if something was used recently, it will be used again. If something wasn't used recently, it won't be used again. So you want to replace the oldest value, but we don't have the information here to know what the oldest value is. And just like what we did when we didn't have information to know whether a value was valid or what address it came from, we're going to add it. So we're going to add something to every set to tell us, hey, which of these values is most recent? So, for example, I can say, have this set to 1 if the second block of the set is the least recent, and 0 if the first one is. So in this case, 6.0 was and 6.1 was accessed most long ago, because we just accessed 0.0. So the correct value for this is 1, indicating that 6.0.6.1 should be the thing we replace. This is if we have a least recently used replacement policy. There's a bit of overhead in having this information. So we have to update it every single time we read from the cache. Because we want to keep track of what we read most recently. We don't just want to know when we brought it in for memory. This also gets more complicated if I decide to have, instead of 2 things in the cache, I decide to have 4 or 8. That makes this a lot harder to keep track of, because I don't just need 1 bit, I need something more complicated. So least recently used isn't our only option, but it's a pretty good ideal if you believe in locality. So as we mentioned last time, most processors are going to use least recently used or an approximation, because this is the best way of taking advantage of temporal locality. So if you believe all your programs have temporal locality, that's the best thing to do, assuming that it's not too expensive. And with a two-way cache, we need 1 bit to keep track of what's least recently used. In general, you can use this formula, log 2 of e factorial is the minimum number of bits you need to keep track of it. So the overhead gets higher and higher the wider your cache gets. And for that reason, people often use an approximation for a cache with a high number of items per set, the E in our textbook. And good approximations let you use around E bits to keep track of something, which is almost the same thing, but it's sometimes wrong. Sometimes it will say something's least recently used, and maybe it's like third least recently used or something like that. So other things you can do are like first in, first out. You can just keep a counter of what the last thing you placed, last place you placed, and place in the next place in the cache. So that's a lot less state. You don't have to update it on every read. So it's a policy some people have used, just because it's easier to implement. It's worse for hit rate, because it's more often we're going to replace something that we're going to access again soon, but it's way easier to implement. And the easiest to implement policy, which yes, some real processors use, is random. Just choose randomly. That means you don't need to store anything in the cache. You can make a random decision without looking at something in the cache. And it turns out to be not terrible. So those are our replacement policies, and those can be used whatever our whenever, anytime we have multiple places to put a block. So I showed you a two-way associative cache. So we had two places to put each thing in a block. And there's some special terminology for different types of associativities that our textbook uses that you should be familiar with. So we started off with direct map caches. And a direct map is just another way of saying one-way set associative. So the general term is it's one-way set associative. We just call it direct mapped because that's easier and because that's the history of how caches were named. Sometimes you'll hear about fully associative caches. So a fully associative cache has one set in total. So how many index bits are in a fully associative cache? How many index bits do we use to look up a value in a fully associative cache? Yes? Zero. There's one set total. We already know what set it is. We don't need to look at any bits from the address. So that's our degenerate case. And you know, if it were cheap enough, we want all our caches to be fully associative because we have the most flexibility about where to place values. But that's just not fast to implement. So usually we'll have some way set associative where the number of ways is like less than 30. So let's go back to the formulas I showed earlier for computing offset bits, and let's add back that E that we complained that was in the textbook and was missing earlier. So E is the number of blocks we have per set. Sometimes these are called ways. And the calculation of the set in index bits and the offset bits is the same, but the cache size, we need to take into account that we have some block size, some number of sets, and some number of blocks per set that's not one anymore, because we're not just dealing with direct mapped. So this, our cache size is B times S times this E, this number of blocks per set. And this tells you everything you need to know to find out how caches use addresses. So as an exercise, I've given you the formulas for reference. And here are the caches on my laptop. So I looked up what they were. So I have an L1 cache with just 32 kilobytes. That's its size. So that doesn't include metadata like tags. So you don't need to worry about that. It's just the blocks. It has 8 blocks per set. And it has 64 byte blocks. My L2 is a bit bigger, has only 4 blocks per set. And my L3 is 4 megabytes and has 16 blocks per set. And this is enough information to say, take this physical memory address and determine how the cache is going to use that to find tag, index, and offset. So with a piece of paper and consulting the person next to you to see if you have the same idea how to start on this, figure this out, how to split this address up for each of these. Yeah?
So capital B is the block size, so in this case it's 64.
Yes.
And then the block offset will be like 6. Yes. Because in the previous example you used, it said that there were 4 byte blocks.
Yeah.
But your little b was 1, so I wasn't sure why. That was
because
not.
Little b, it was should have been 2. Because
the example is that it was really bothering me. It said 4 byte blocks, but then there
it
were
might
2.
Be copy and pasting in slides.
Yeah, because there were 2 elements per block, but offset was 1, so that makes sense, but wouldn't that just be a 2-byte block then?
It's 2-byte blocks. There's 1 offset bit for 2 bytes, right? 2 to the 1.
Right.
If it's 4 bytes, there should be 2, yes. And if that was different on my slides, it was an error.
Okay, cool. Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Okay. In the offset bit. Yeah,
Yes, you have to buy it.
Do you have a 64-bit computer?
What?
It is a 64-bit computer.
Yes.
So you have to determine how big the set is.
So that's just
or I don't know, he's using how many sets are. We need numbers of sets.
How many sets
we
can do?
We actually have to determine how many sets are first. Then we can walk up. So how many sets we have total?
So that's the thing about this is what I'm going to ask. It just be.
Do you know the block size for 32 kilobytes. Well, how many? Oh. So what's this? 10, right?
Yeah, 10.
So who thinks they're on the right track? Who has no clue? Okay. So does someone who thinks they're on the right track want to say what they're starting by doing? Yes.
The first thing I did was find the number of sets.
Okay. So that's a very good thing to do. So we have a formula for the number of sets, which is 2 to the number of set index bits. And also, the number of sets is related to the cache size. So you should probably solve one of those for the number of sets. And that's a very good place to start. So any other starting points that people started with?
So 64
2 to 302. Is it
52
for the tag for L1?
I didn't actually calculate that. I just figured out which parts of the address it was.
Oh, okay.
Oh wait, no. So how many blocks? How many bytes are in a set?
Wait, that was no sense. So you can start. All right, never mind.
Okay, so does anyone have an answer for any of the offset index or tag for any of the caches? Yeah.
All right, so for the L1 cache, the tag is the 3 and the 4 in base 2 binary, which is 0011 0100.
Okay.
And then the index is the next 6 bits, which is 010101, and then the offset is the final 6 bits.
Okay. And how did you figure out, let's say, the offset?
So what I did was I did a sort of like started, now that since we knew the cache size, I found the number of sets, and then I found took the log of that to get the index bits. You know that the tag bits are always going to be the first 6 or
the first eight
of each. Or no, is it the first? I'm like confusing myself.
So okay. So how do we get the? So you're talking about getting the number of set bits.
Yeah.
How about the number? Who can tell me how to get the number of?
You just subtract
offset bits. Yeah, so we have this formula here, which is the block size, which I've told you, is 64, equals 2 to the b. And if you vaguely remember some algebra, which I know it's been a while, the way you solve this is by taking the log base 2 of both sides. It's probably been a while since you've done logarithms, so I understand that this may not be something you're really comfortable with, but it's going to come up a lot because we're dealing with powers of 2 here. This is also where that powers of 2 that Luther talked about earlier in the semester becomes really important, just for convenience, because this is something where we're dealing with powers of 2 all over the place. So when I start doing this problem, I usually don't start with the number of sets, which is fine to do, but I start with the block size and the block offset bits, because usually that's the easiest thing to figure out. Not always. And here we know the block size, so I can figure out the block offset bits. And also, it happens to be the same for all of the caches. So, hey, I figured out the offset bits for 3 of the answers. I'm a third of the way there. And that's definitely the easiest part, because we only had to use one formula. So the next thing is that we're going to want to find the number of sets. And that's a little less straightforward. And the formula we're going to use for that is the cache size one, because we have the cache sizes. And we also have the number of blocks in a set. So we have the cache size, the number of blocks in a set, and we also have the block size. So we have everything but the number of sets in this formula. So we can fill in all the other values, and we can solve for s, and we can just plug in our values, and we get the number of sets in the cache. And that's just doing some algebra. That's, one way of doing this is you can just memorize these formulas, write them down, and then do some algebra to manipulate them and figure out how to get the value you want. So after rearranging and plugging in that 32 kilobytes that I just was given, and that 8 ways that I was just given, I get that there's 64 sets. And then I have the formula for the set that includes the number of sets and the set index bits. Number of sets is 2 to the set index bits. And I want to solve that for little s. So I take the log 2 of both sides. And I get 6, just like was stated. So this is for the L1. So we can do the same thing for the L2 and L3. It's just going to be different numbers here. Now, once we have the number of block offset bits and the number of set index bits, everything left over is the tag. So for dividing the address up, I'm not even going to bother to compute the number of tag bits. I'm just going to find the offset and the set, and everything I don't use is the tag. You could compute the number of tag bits, but I don't find it particularly useful in this case. So the answers you should get from doing that are, these sizes. And so are there any questions about getting this far, figuring out these sizes based on this algebra? Yeah. On this. So once you have these sizes, that doesn't completely answer the question, because we actually need to figure out what the value of the offset and index are. Now, I want you to get far enough that if I gave you a picture of this cache, you could say, which row do we use? You could circle it. So we actually need to take the address we were given, 0x34567, and split it up into these different pieces, the offset, the index, and the tag. So we have 6 offset bits for every single cache, which means these bottom 6 bits, these least significant 6 bits of our address, are going to be the offset. So bits 0 through 5, and we can write down what those that is in binary and get the number. And this is how I usually write down hexadecimal numbers as binary, so I can actually figure out what's going on, rather than trying to do some multiplication or something to figure it out. So there's our offset. And then we want to get the set index bits. And we know the set that the order is tag index offset. Just memorize that order. So the index is bits come right before the offset bits. So we stopped here for the offset. So everything just before it, that must be where the index is. And we know there's 6 bits of it. So these 6 bits are going to be the set number in our L1 cache. So which of the 64 sets it is? It's 1/5 of the 64, you know, hex 1/5 of the 64 possible sets is where this address is going to be looked up. And everything left over, all this stuff we didn't use, this hex 3/4 at the top, is going to be our tag. And that's what we need to know when we look something up in that set, which value, you know, from memory, you know, do we have? Is it the one we want? And you can do the same procedure for the L2, where instead of having 6 bits, you have 10, just because the L2 had more sets. And you get 10 bits before the offset, and you get a different set number. And again, everything that's left over, in this case, this zero, this hex 3, is our tag. And the same procedure applies to the L3, which just has a more sets. It happened to be the case that all these caches had the same block size, so the offsets were all the same. And this is going to be pretty common in real systems because it's easy to pass around the same size of data. Not always, but usually that's what you'll see. So questions about this part of the procedure of going from our number of bits to actually splitting up the address? So that gives us our actual answers, our final answers, not just the sizes, but the address split. Okay, so given this, we've gone through like basically everything you need to do to figure out how caches read values, including how they insert values that they read so that later on they'll have a copy. And we've done this for our set associative caches and our direct map caches. What we haven't talked about is writing. Because our cache, remember, is our data memory and our which allows us to write values. And we haven't told you what happens when I say, hey, I want to write a byte to memory. How does that work? So there's multiple options for implementing this. The simplest one is the cache, you know, changes the value if it has it. And if it doesn't, it just, and or even if it does, it just sends it to memory. And this is called write through. So that's the simplest option, and there are real caches which do this, where they might update their copy, but they always update memory. And if they don't have a copy, they still update memory. Another option is that the cache can store the value that was written, and remember that it's dirty. Dirty meaning different than memory. We call values clean if they're the same as memory and dirty otherwise. And later on, we might read something which goes to the same site as the cache. and we're going to replace this dirty value. And what the cache is going to need to do is going to need to write that value out before it's replaced. If it doesn't do that, we'll forget about the change we made. And we don't want to forget about this write, because then our program would behave incorrectly. It would be funny to write a value to memory and not be able to read it back later. So when we replace this stored value that we didn't write right away, we're going to actually need to write it back, which presumably will happen eventually. So where this is a win is, you know, maybe we write this value multiple times before we need to replace it, in which case, hey, we've saved writing to memory. Or at least we've delayed writing to memory. So write back is usually, you know, more complicated to implement, but usually faster for this, because, you know, we're doing less work, you know, sometimes, and at least doing less work right away. So to implement this, we need to remember, is this value I have here, is it, you know, the original value from memory, or is it something I changed? We need to remember, this value I have here, you know, will I need to actually send it to memory when I'm done with it, or do I not need to do anything when I get rid of it? And caches do this with what's called a dirty bit. So just like we have a valid bit to say, is this value a real value or something that, you know, it's just a placeholder until I load something from memory? We have a bit which says, is this value the same as memory, or is it something that I'm responsible for updating memory with so that the program actually reads back the value it changed? So in a write back, if we don't do write through, we need to have this extra bit. And that's part of the overhead we have, in addition to the logic when we're replacing a value to send it to memory. So there's another decision besides write back and write through about writing, which is whether we allocate on write or not. Because typically, we have a cache block like 64 bytes. When you write a program, you typically do not write 64 bytes at a time. You write a lot less. So this means that the cache can't actually do this, because it actually stores, you know, ABCE, ABCF, and so on. So it can't just take this write and put a value in its cache. It needs to get the rest from memory if it wants to store that. It either needs to already have it or get the rest from memory. So there are two choices about the policy there. So if you have the value in your cache already, you're obviously going to keep it there, and you're just going to update it, regardless of what your policy is. But if you don't have it, there's a question of whether you put that in your cache or not. And there's a cost to putting in your cache, because you need to read the rest of the stuff in the block. Because you can't just store part of a block. You don't have any way of knowing that, oh, yeah, this is that block of memory, but I only have the second, third, and fourth bytes. I don't have the first and the fifth, so don't read those. You don't have that in our cache. So we need to get the whole block from memory. And the policy of doing that on every write is called write allocate. So that means that if we write a value and we don't have it in our cache, we're going to put it in our cache. And there's another policy, which is write no allocate, which means if we don't already have it in our cache, we're not going to put it in our cache. We're not going to spend the time talking to memory to read the value. We're just going to write a little bit to memory rather than reading a lot from memory, the whole block. And, you know, it's not actually as clear which of these policies is better, because you have to ask, you know, if I'm writing a value now, am I likely to read it soon? And that's a question about how programs behave. So with outright allocate, if let's say we're writing into address 4, it goes into this. With write allocate, if we're writing into address 4 here, we're going to replace a block, possibly write it back, and then read in the new block and replace the value that was actually written, the part of the block that was written. So this means that with a write allocate, write back cache, this one write caused our cache to need to write back an old block, read in a new block, so two memory accesses for one cache access. And this is sort of the added complexity we have. And of course, we also, like every access, needed to update our LRU information. With write no allocate, things are simpler. You know, you say, oh, is this in our cache? Nope, we're just gonna send it off. So that's what I have for today. So we talked about all sorts of organization of caches. So we'll finish up talking about, you know, how these things, how all these choices we have in our caches affect performance next time, and about how you write code to perform well with caches.